David. Well, thank you for that introduction. I'm Sue, as David has just said, and this is Paul, and this is Andy Wyatt. I'm going to do the first four slides, and then we're going to hand over to the guys. But just a little bit about myself and Paul. I work for full-time for Leicestershire County Council. I am the workforce lead for children's social care. So all the social care training falls under myself. And I've been involved with children's services for about 15 years. Before that, I came into my role as a parent, advocating for families who have children with disabilities. Paul came into his role via engineering, and then he went into coordinating services for children with life-limiting illnesses. Then he went on and managed a load of projects. Have you heard of Sure Start? Yeah, he set up 8 children's centres in the most deprived area of Leicestershire, managing about 20 staff and partners. And then you got out of local authority, but then went back in as LADO, so local authority's designated officer, so responsible for allegations management and investigating allegations where there's been an allegation and whistleblowing about an adult working with children and vulnerable young people. And Paul is full-time elder, part-time paid at our church, and the other part of the week he has the training bit. We'll talk a little bit more about where Christian Safeguarding Services comes in a little while. But I just want to introduce Andy. Andy Wyatt is an elder down at a church in Chessington. Epsom. It's near. And Andy was an assistant director of children's services and an ex-Ofsted inspector. So we have him on board and we are so grateful. We have somebody else on board who's not with us today, who was a chief exec of children and adult services down in South Wales. And he is also going to be involved with us, but we're going to talk about that developing later on. So without further ado, I'm going to talk to you about how we're going to run the session. So we've titled it, What's Changing in Safeguarding? We are working in partnership with Evangelical Alliance, the FIEC, Affinity, and Christian Institute, national organisations who are gospel-driven. And we've had some meetings with these guys for about 12 months now, coming up 12 months, latterly Christian Institute just at the beginning of this month. So we are working in partnership with these four organisations. I've done that. We're going to look at the current climate nationally, what's going on nationally, how that impacts in our churches, the current climate for our churches in safeguarding. We're going to think about what is it? What is safeguarding? What's required? What does the law require of us when we're safeguarding children, young people, and vulnerable adults or adults at risk? And we're going to talk to you a little bit about what Christian Safeguarding Services is and how we can help you. Okay. So, without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Paul.
Hi, folks. What we want to do today, as Sue said, is just kind of give you an overview. Now, we can't get into a huge amount of detail today. So what we're going to do is provide an overview, and then we are going to allow time for questions and answers, but we will be around after the event as well, so that if there are questions, you can ask us later on. So we wanted to just sort of set the scene, really, to start off with. Safeguarding has always been an area where there has been rapid movement, rapid change. But that's particularly the case over more recent years. And I guess that's been driven by a number of things. Some of those things positive, very proactive in trying to improve practice. Some of them quite negative in terms of responding where things have gone wrong. And so you'll be familiar with some of the historic cases. Big national inquiry at the moment looking at historic cases where people have been abused. And unfortunately, we have to say that the church has not been exempt from that. I use the term church, of course, in a very, very broad sense there. But you know, Christian churches have not been exempt. We have not been whiter than white historically. And that has set something of the backdrop that we're going to talk about as we go through the session. Now, some of the things I'm going to talk about today are very specific to churches. Others of them are very general. And that thing about historic abuse is a general one. It's been right the way across the whole of society, including local authorities, including private sector, including health services, you know, right across the whole section of society. But what it has resulted in is an increasing suspicion right across the board of anybody who's working with children. And of course, in more recent times, there's been an increasing suspicion, particularly of those of us who are operating in the voluntary sector. Much bigger than just the church, obviously. We talk about the faith sector, which is all faith. We talk about the Christian community, and we talk about the voluntary sector, which is non-faith-based organisations as well. But right across that, there has been an increasing suspicion. And of course, the recent problems that Oxfam have experienced have fed into that. But that's not been an isolated example. There have been lots of those kinds of things. So what we're seeing is a greater level of suspicion. If you go back, even probably only as little as a couple of decades, I think there was a general assumption that people who volunteered were basically good people and were pretty safe. I think that has largely disappeared now because of things that have gone wrong in the past. And so there is that suspicion. I think the other thing that we need to acknowledge as churches is that there are increasing expectations. Now, we're going to talk today a little bit about the legislation and the guidance, but one of the problems that we experience is that the legislation and the guidance may not appear to have changed a huge amount, but the expectation that is kind of written between the lines has increased significantly. And if you're not doing the kind of reading between the lines, you won't necessarily see the way that things have changed. It doesn't jump off the page at you. And so there are these kind of increasing expectations. There's increasing expectations of us organisationally, that as churches, there's an expectation that we will up our game and that we'll improve the quality of safeguarding. But there's also an expectation that there will be increased transparency. What we mean by that is that we don't just do the right thing. That obviously is important, but that we're seen to be doing the right thing. Which is equally important. I don't want to get too bogged down in examples here, but for example, if you've been following the stuff that's been going on with Sovereign Grace Ministries, you'll be familiar with what I'm talking about here. The question marks are over how a problem was handled. It's not so much a question of, you know, what was the actual core problem, but it's about the way that the leadership handled that and the lack of openness and the lack of transparency and the lack of passing things to actual authorities who were supposed to deal with it. So a real push towards greater transparency, being seen to be doing the right thing rather than simply doing the right thing. And there's also an increasing expectation in terms of personal competence. Now, what I mean by this is that the people who are actually working for us in our kids' works, in our Sunday schools, sorry, just as we go through the session, when I say work, I don't mean paid, okay? There is no distinction in law between someone who gets paid and someone who doesn't. So when I talk about people working for us, even if I talk about employees, unless I explicitly say differently, I'm including volunteers in that, okay? Because in law, there is no distinction between the two. Okay, if I'm talking specifically about people who are paid, I'll make that clear. But the vast majority of the time, I'm talking about our volunteers as well. And what the pressure has been is towards greater competence. Now, what do we mean by competence? What we mean by competence is this. I think the best way to explain it is to do a contrast. Okay. In the olden days, what we used to do was expect that everybody knew what safeguarding was, knew what child protection was, knew what to do if they had a concern. They knew. They could tell you the correct answer to the question. Now, of course, there's a problem with knowledge, isn't there? And of course, the problem with knowledge is it doesn't actually keep anybody safe at all. Okay. It only keeps people safe when we put that knowledge into practice. Okay, so if I give you an example, I am supposed to be losing weight. I lost about 3 stone. I've put on about 4 and I'm just beginning to lose weight again. Okay, now, do I know how to lose weight? Well, with all due respect, it's not that complicated. It is simple maths, calories in, calories out. It's relatively straightforward, right? I know how to do it. However, standing before you, it's fairly obvious that I don't do what I know I should do. Right. If any of you had to attend a speed awareness course, and I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but if you've had to attend a speed awareness course recently, or even in a slight distant, more distant past, you know, do we know that we're supposed to drive paying attention to the changes in the speed limits? Yes. Do we always do it? Okay. Sometimes we fall foul of that unintentionally. We didn't realise. We were perhaps driving along a new stretch of road, didn't realise the speed limit had changed. Sometimes we're just pushing our luck and we get caught. But the point is, knowledge is not the same as competence. Competence is doing what we know we should do. Okay? And the emphasis is on competence, not on knowledge. In other words, if all we're doing is kind of bringing all our volunteers together, do a training session, off we go, and then forget about it until the next time it's due, that's not good enough anymore. It used to be. A few years back, it was okay. It's not the case anymore. What we're looking at is, are people actually doing the right thing, not do they know how to do the right thing? Okay. And this is it's quite obvious and straightforward, isn't it? Now, there is another challenge for us. Again, this isn't specific to churches, but it is a challenge for us. And over more recent times, the government have moved in a direction of less and less instruction as to what to do, and a more general description of what we need to achieve. In other words, they say, this is what you must achieve. You must achieve keeping people safe. You must achieve identifying people who are at risk of abuse and doing something to prevent that where that's possible. Or if someone has experienced abuse, you need to take the right action to respond to that. But they don't tell us how to do it as much as they used to. In the olden days, it used to be very clear. They gave you a set of instructions and everybody followed the same instructions and everything was fine. Except it wasn't, because it was just a kind of very tick-boxy process, okay? Now, what we're being told is what you need to do is devise systems, devise policies, etc., that work for you in your context. Now, that's great, isn't it? Because what it means is that we don't have to pretend that we're a huge organisation. I guess we're all from independent churches, or there may be the odd person who maybe isn't, but the majority are from independent churches, aren't we? We're not part of a huge denomination that's either operating nationally or internationally. And so our context is quite different. So it allows us to say, no, we're going to tailor our approach to safeguarding to our individual context. The downside, of course, is that if you're going to devise a sensible system, you need to understand it in far more detail than you do if you're simply following the rules. And so there's a far greater expectation that we will actually understand not just what to do, but why we are doing it the way that we are, rather than simply following a set of instructions. I'm going to suggest to you later that many churches, I believe, not all, and I want to be really clear about this, there are some churches who are very, very hot on safeguarding, but I think there's a significant number of churches who actually are existing in something of a time warp. Okay, around about 2004, 2005, there was quite significant change in legislation and we all got ourselves up to speed and then we've just kind of ticked along from there. And we haven't taken account of the fact that there's been a lot of changes since then. We're just kind of going, well, we've got our policy and we do our DBS checks, so we're okay, aren't we? And the answer now, unfortunately, is no. It's not good enough nowadays just to have a policy in place and to do your DBS checks. There's more stuff that needs to go on alongside that. So there's less prescription, but there's increased expectation. As I've already mentioned, increased suspicion, and that's both of churches, but also in a broadening, in another sense. We're going to talk about this a bit more in a moment. Andy's going to talk about it, but there's a far broader definition now of what safeguarding is all about. And I'm not going to steal Andy's thunder, so I'm going to leave that for him, but that's a part of this picture too. We're seeing social shifts. We know this, don't we, as churches? We're wrestling with things that even 10 years ago were probably unthinkable. Things like same-sex marriage, for example, right? Now, we've got to start thinking these kind of things through. And so there's all kinds of social shifts that are going on, some of which are being reflected in legislation, others which aren't. And the problem that we have is that what's happening is that society is moving. We're staying where we were. Previously, we were kind of broadly in line with the society at large. But now, we haven't changed any, but we're seen as being antiquated, archaic, even evil. In some of the views that we would hold on some of these issues. And so we've got to operate in this kind of an environment as well. And we want to talk very much about something that is really important. Now, we've not got time to go into lots and lots of details, but I want to be very clear about this. What we're dealing with here not only is what happens, it's how we deal with things that happen. It's what we refer to as reputational risk. Okay. Now, reputational risk comes down to this. You cannot guarantee as a church that you're not going to have someone comes into the church who starts to volunteer for you and who isn't genuinely saved, who's not working out biblical principles, or maybe they are saved and they fall into some kind of a sin and they abuse somebody. You can't avoid that. But the way that you respond to it matters. The way you respond if you have a problem matters. The way you respond if a young person comes into church and discloses some kind of abuse that's happened outside the church that's nothing to do with the church matters. And it's what we refer to as reputational damage or reputational risk. This is one of the highest risk factors that we have actually as churches. It's kind of the idea here is this. If something goes wrong and we don't deal with it well, the suspicion comes on us that what we were doing is covering up. Now, it's broader than just that, okay? It's broader than just that. But the idea here is if we are perceived to have been in any way negligent or involved in that abuse, it will damage the cause of the gospel. It will damage that church's reputation for at least a generation and probably well beyond that, okay? Now, we can handle things well and we can minimise that effect. But if we don't handle it well, reputational damage is a huge thing that we have to be thinking about and we have to be managing. Safeguarding isn't a gospel issue in the sense that it's not about preaching the gospel. It's not about preaching salvation in the Lord Jesus Christ. But it is a gospel issue in the sense that it's about working out our biblical principles. And it is a gospel issue in the sense that if we get it right, we won't get any credit. But if we get it wrong, we will bring the gospel into disrepute. That's just the basic fact of life. You're not going to get a pat on the back for doing it well, but you get it wrong and you will hit the front page of the newspaper. Okay, and that's just the reality of the environment that we're living in, unfortunately. So what about for churches? Well, there's national stuff that's going on that's very interesting at the moment. Now, some of this is going to be anticipatory. Okay, there was an attempt recently to introduce regulation of churches so that all churches had to be registered with the government. That's been knocked on the head. We're not expecting that issue to go away, okay? We think it's likely to raise its head, if not in the same format, in a different format at some point in the future, okay? Now, of course, I'm saying of course, for me it's an of course, what we want to do is we want to honour the Lord by honouring those that he has set in authority over us. That's what the Lord tells us to do, to honour the government, to honour those that the Lord has set in authority over us. And so we need to be careful about that. But we're also having to think carefully because the culture is shifting very significantly and there are conflicts, there are tensions. Now, we believe that it's perfectly doable to navigate our way through that, but there are these kinds of tensions. There are certain national pressures. Some of those pressures are around regulation. And some of those have arisen from some of the CSE cases that we've seen. CSE, child sexual exploitation. So things like Rotherham and Rochdale and these kinds of things. They are being presented now as a religious issue. Now, obviously, it's not a Christian issue, but it is being presented as a religious issue. Now, I think the vast majority of Muslims would be as offended by what has happened as we are. I don't think it's a religious issue at all. But what I'm saying is that there is a pressure to present it as a religious issue. And therefore, all these religious people need to be regulated because they're dangerous, is the thought process that is going on. Now, I don't want to get today into a kind of scaremongering thing. I really am not a prophet of doom. I think that the current situation presents us many, many gospel opportunities. But we do need to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. We need to be wise. And this is the way that certain people are trying to present it. Now, I don't think there's a genuine agenda. I think there's an agenda behind that, which is about trying to restrict religious privilege as it is seen. But the fact remains that those kinds of pressures are coming through. There's also been quite a big discussion about the use of the term spiritual abuse. And you may have come across that terminology. Now, before I say anything about the use of the term spiritual abuse, I want to be very, very clear about one thing. What I want to be very clear about is there is abuse of power that takes place in the context of churches. I don't mean in every church, right? But as a phenomenon, that happens. And where that happens, it is unbiblical, it is unacceptable, and it is sometimes illegal, and we need to deal with it in those ways. We need to see it in that way, okay? So there is a phenomenon. However, there is a broader discussion around the use of the term spiritual abuse. There are some legal issues around that, in the sense that I believe there is a very strong argument to say that the use of the term spiritual abuse is actually discriminatory. Because what it is abuse of power within a religious context. It's no different in its essence, in my view, to the abuse of a power, for example, within a football club context. That's hit the media recently, hasn't it? Where coaches have used the promise of a future to perpetrate abuse and to manipulate people into a position that they want. And so there are concerns. Now, we haven't got lots of time to go into the question of spiritual abuse, and I don't want to go into that particularly. What I want to do is just point you to what I think is a very, very helpful summary of the issues, which is on the Evangelical Alliance website. If you go onto their website, and if you simply use their search function and type in spiritual abuse, it will bring up a report that was released in February of this year, where far better brains than mine have been exercised on this question, and I believe they've come up with a very balanced and a very helpful summary of those issues. But what we need to be aware of is that there are those who are not in the Christian community who are using the term spiritual abuse to promote that anti-faith message. Okay, and again, taking us back into a situation where faith groups, there is a pressure for faith groups to be singled out for particular regulation and scrutiny, which is above what we would expect for other comparable groups in the community. Now, we're not legal experts. We're about doing safeguarding well. So I don't want to get into those legal debates. There are other people who can do that far better than I can. But it is a part of the context that we need to be aware of. You may find that the terminology has even worked its way into your policy. If that is the case, what I would recommend is have a read of the EA report, have a look at the issues, and then decide from there whether that is something that you want to leave in there. And I don't want to say anything further than that. But I think there are issues. But I want to be really, really crystal clear. We're not talking here about covering up abuse that happens within the church context. What we're talking about is how do we deal with it? How do we articulate it? And do we actually set it as a separate legal characteristic, or is that discriminatory? And we would argue it's discriminatory and it's not actually helpful. Okay. Now, if anyone wants to talk to us in more detail about this, we're more than happy to do that. But I don't want to take up too much time today. We're also thinking about an increased focus these days on safeguarding adults. And again, we're going to talk a little bit about that. And as I've already said to you, and I've taken too long already, we are thinking here about opportunities for the gospel that this environment is creating. I don't want us to get into a kind of bunker mentality here. What we're going to try and do for the rest of the session is talk to you about how can we excel at this, okay, so that we don't get into a bunker mentality, but we actually lead the way and we set a great example. So I'm going to hand over to Andy, who's going to take you through the next few slides.
Please save your questions till the end. I'm sure there are questions arising. Please hang on to them until we do. But if things come to you, please ask them later. So we're on the next slide. So what is safeguarding? Now, you might treat with some healthy scepticism some of the things that you might read in the media. I'm thinking of the Daily Mail in particular, perhaps, about moral outrage at the way children are seen these days as precious little things that we must never let outside. So we're not talking about that. What we're talking about is trying to keep our children and our vulnerable adults safe as best we can. We don't live in a safe world, do we? Relatively speaking, the UK is a safe place. You can, generally speaking, walk down the streets, although I wouldn't recommend it after 10 o'clock in Torquay this evening. There'll be a lot of Christians around. but if you... So we're not talking about keeping everybody safe all the time from everything. We're talking about, as churches, trying to keep people as safe as we possibly can within a normal environment. So, for example, a question you might want to ask, which has come straight out of the Daily Mail, is would you let your children, after church, play Conkers? Something to take away and think about. So, what we're talking about here is upholding individual rights and protecting vulnerable people from abuse or neglect. And we'll get into that just a little bit more in a moment. It's important to recognise that there are two separate legal frameworks for the protection and safeguarding of children and adults. We are going to concentrate primarily on children today. We're not going to open the Pandora's box of adults too much today, but simply because of time. So we're going to be talking primarily about children. So we're talking about children, protecting children from maltreatment, preventing the impairment of children's health or development, ensuring children grow up in circumstances consistent with the provision of safe and effective care, and taking action to enable all children to have the best outcomes. I'll unpack that in a moment in the next slide. But here's a question for you. You don't have to answer it right now, but you might want to have a stab at it later. We've probably got some trustees in the room. Raise your hand if you're a trustee. Yeah, I thought you would. So I want you to think about, maybe you can answer this question now, actually. What are your two major risks, trustees? I'm sure you've all thought about this. Gareth, what did you say? Financial and safeguarding. 100% correct. Well done. There you're two. If you didn't know that and you're a trustee, you've learned something from this session. Good. So when you come together as trustees, you want to be following the money and you want to be raising this issue and making sure that children are safe in your church. So what we're talking about here is, I'll come on to this in the next slide, but a spectrum of safeguarding. So for example, and this kind of illustrates the ways that we see safeguarding these days as much more broadly than we used to. We used to see it as child protection, didn't we? Now we see it as broader than that. For example, you would take measures, wouldn't you, to ensure that the computers in your home and in your church building, if you have one, or the school in which you meet and so on, are safe for your children to use. That might mean installing particular types of software and firewalls and so on. But online safety is a massive issue for children and young people. If, like me, you've got not very much grey hair, it's a relatively new thing for you to think about. But actually, it's a massive issue for anybody over about 8 years old. Huge issue. Safeguarding adults. I did say I would mention it, but that's pretty much all we're going to do. What we could say here is that there is, again, a broad spectrum of what safeguarding adults might look like. So your church, hopefully, will have people in it who may have mental health issues, who may have physical disabilities, who may have learning disabilities. We're a funny old bunch, to use Don Carson's phrase. I don't think he quite used those words, but yes, we're an ungodly mess. And we have all sorts of people in our churches. Praise God for that. And it's incumbent on us to make sure that we treat everybody with the respect that inherently, because they share the image of God with us, that we look after them properly. So if we could go to the next. Thanks, Paul. Why does it work for you and not for me? Okay. So this is what we were talking about before. If you work in the field, you might have seen something that looks more like a rainbow, but essentially it's the same thing. It's a spectrum where over on the left-hand side, you can go with that one. Thanks, Paul. You start on the right-hand side. So I start on the right-hand side. Okay. So what we used to talk about and what I did for years and years and years as a job was over this side of the things, working under the 1989 Children Act. Emma Thompson, recent film. That's probably about as much as some of us know about the Children Act. It's worth going away and reading it. It was drawn up in its framework by a Christian, Lord Mackay. Section 47, which is jargon, but actually is in the Children Act, Section 47, gives the local authority the duty to investigate circumstances where a child may be at risk of significant harm being the legal definition, and puts on the local authority the duty to investigate, to make inquiries where action may be required to protect the child. They don't do that on their own, they do that with the police and health services and so on. At the other end of the spectrum, we've got universal services. So, for example, if you have a baby, more than likely you're going to have a midwife. You may be fortunate enough to get a visit from a health visitor. Health visitors are generally working up the scale these days with quite heavy caseloads of 70-plus children. So they're not interested in your baby unless there's more risks going further along the spectrum. But children who go to school, it's a universal service. Needs can generally be met within that universal service. So they're meeting their developmental milestones. No real concerns for them, although they could probably behave better in class. Needs met by universal services. That's where most children are. A substantial minority need services, not necessarily from the local authority, but need services further along the spectrum. So we talk about early help these days, Sure Start, children's centres, all kinds of things, including health visitor support as well. Early help for families who just need a bit of extra support in raising their children, where there may be an identified concern. It may be a health issue for a child, or there may be a risk of poor outcomes for that child. Some children born with certain conditions where you know that they're going to have special educational needs. An early intervention may be required to help parents look after those children. And again, services from the local authority, from the health authority, from schools and so on. And the point there is to reduce the risk and to prevent escalation. You'll know under government policy, because of budget cuts within local authorities, some of this stuff is now starting to be at risk. So children are more likely to enter the system further along the right-hand side. Specialist child in need. So Section 17 of the Children Act places a duty on the local authority to provide services so that children don't get caught up in Section 47. Any kind of range of services, and again, that includes children's centres and Sure Start and all kinds of other things. A child with disabilities is likely to be regarded, depending on the severity, as a child in need. They won't necessarily get a social worker as such, but they may be entitled to services to enable them to achieve the best outcome. But these children are perhaps unlikely to achieve or maintain a reasonable level of health or development. So the outcomes looking forward for them may not be looking that great. So families are going to need extra support to achieve the best outcomes for them. Just a quick thought before we finish that spectrum of safeguarding, about reputational risk. Reputational risk is very important for churches for the reasons that Paul's already outlined. The same applies to every other organisation that works with children and young people. So the press, obviously, clearly, the media love to have a field day when they can criticise anybody or anything that has failed in its duty towards children. Churches are particularly vulnerable, as Paul's saying, to failures in this area.
Now, we've taken quite a bit of time to kind of set the background. And what we want to do now is to talk you through the sort of the framework of things that you need to have in place. Now, I'm not going to go through these slides in huge, huge detail, okay, because I'm quite keen to get to the point where we can open up for any questions that folks have. But as I said to you before, in the olden days, we used to kind of basically say, okay, so long as you've got a policy in place and so long as you're doing a DBS check, or as it was at the time, a CRB check, you're pretty much on target as a church, you should be okay. We think now that there are kind of six areas that we need to be thinking through. And I want to talk you through this slide because there's a slide for each one of those. But there's just the kind of summary of the kinds of things that as churches we need to be thinking through. Okay, so the first of those is our policies. Clearly, you need a safeguarding policy. Okay, whether or not you are doing any direct work with children, you need a safeguarding policy. Now, the reason you need a safeguarding policy, even if you don't have a kids' work or even if you're not doing any work with adults who are particularly at risk, is you don't know who is going to walk through the door of the church. So unless you have your family and you lock the front door and don't let anybody in, then you need a safeguarding policy. Okay? Now, what I want to be very clear about as we go through these slides is we've kind of gone, here's a whole stack of stuff you need to think about. What I want to emphasize here is we're not suggesting to you that every church needs all of these. Which ones of these you will need will vary dependent upon what kind of work you're doing. Okay, so if you're not doing any work with vulnerable people, you just need a fairly basic safeguarding policy and some risk assessments and some basic stuff in place. If you've got kids' work, you need to focus on some of these. If you're working with vulnerable adults, i.e. let's say you've got a group that you run, maybe for sort of older people who are suffering with dementia so that they're particularly vulnerable, you're going to need another set of policies. If you're doing any real, real specialist work, and I'm talking the kind of social action type stuff where you've got, you're doing real sort of in-depth work with, say, homeless people or people who are misusing substances or anything like that, you're going to have to notch it up again, okay? So this is about thinking about what are we doing and what is a sensible and a proportionate response to what we're doing, okay? So I don't want you to look at this and go, oh my word, we can't possibly do all that, because you probably don't need to do all of that. But what you do need to do is think about, do we need to do all of that? Yeah, that's all it's there for. It's just to prompt your thoughts. Now, again, I'm not going to go through these in huge detail, as I've already said, but a safeguarding policy that covers both children and adults is essential unless you don't have any people. Okay, if you have people, you need a safeguarding policy. It is as straightforward as that. Now, if you are doing any work where you have anybody operating on your behalf with vulnerable people, so you've got a Sunday school, you've got kids clubs, you've got youth club, you're doing anything with adults who would fit into that category of adults at risk of abuse, so those very vulnerable adults, you have got to be thinking about safe recruitment. That includes DBS checks, but please don't only run on your DBS check, okay? It needs to be embedded in a broader system, okay? All the DBS check tells you is whether that person has been convicted, okay? That's all it tells you, okay? It tells you whether they have committed an offence. It doesn't tell you that they haven't committed an offence, it just tells you they haven't been caught, right? And so what you don't want to do is wait until we know somebody's dangerous to actually keep people safe from them, right? We don't wait for that person to harm a child before we say they're dangerous and they're not going to. You want to be anticipating this. So there needs to be a broader framework around sort of references and all of these kinds of things. Now, I've not got time to go into that in detail, but we have got information available around those kinds of things. We do need to be thinking, therefore, about how we recruit and retain our volunteers. We do need, for example, to be doing interviews with staff where we lay very clearly what we expect them. It's not a competitive interview, right? But if you're going to just kind of let somebody come in on the basis that they've got a clear DBS check and you kind of you think you know who they are, then you're probably in a dodgy situation, okay? We need to just be thinking a bit more broadly than that. Another one that I think is really important for all of us is a complaint procedure. Now, of course, we don't like to think in those terms as churches, do we? But actually, if something goes wrong, if somebody's not happy with something that has happened in church, what do they do about it? Do they just put up with it because that's the Christian thing to do? Don't raise a fuss. Or is there actually a way for us to say, no, it's not acceptable for you to be treated in that way, and we want to think about that? So I would suggest to you that that is also an essential one. Technology and social media. How do we think about that? If you have anybody over the age of about 5, you probably need to be thinking about social media and technology. Okay. What sort of age do you think children start using technology these days? 9 months. Yeah. Right. I mean, I came out of Shore Start in 2012, right? So I'm now talking, 5-6 years ago, right? At that point in time, we used to do something called 2-year check. This was about a month either side of the child's second birthday. And we were finding an increasing number of children who knew how to swipe the screen on a device, but didn't know how to turn the page in a physical book. Children now are walking around are being pushed around in pushchairs, they're being taken in car seats that have phone or tablet holders built into them. The beauty of touchscreen technology is once you've got sufficient coordination to move your finger and touch the screen, then you can use technology. So if you have people, you probably need to have a social media policy. If you're in a situation like we are, where we have a lot of students who are 18, 19, and we have some young people who are 16, who are best of friends, you need to think very carefully about how do you manage adults' contact with children on social media. Okay, and yes, they are friends in real life. And yes, I know they go to each other's houses and they have tea and they might have sleepovers and all the rest of it. But as a church, we need to think about how do we deal with social media. One of the risk factors, for example, that you need to think through is that child who has come through your youth work. And they get too old for the youth work and so they become a helper. And now all of a sudden you have a liability, not an asset. Okay? Because you've got to manage those relationships that they had where before the summer break, they were a member of the club and needed to be protected. And now they're a leader. And so we need to be thinking about how we protect the children in the context of that person who's working there. Okay, so there's those kinds of issues. Allegations against staff and volunteers, all these kinds of things. So there's all of these things. Now, these are your policies. Okay. There is no defined structure as to how you have to write a policy. You can have one big policy with lots of chapters. You can have them all as separate documents. It doesn't matter. Your policy is essentially an overarching statement of what is our intent. What are we going to do? And broadly speaking, how are we going to achieve it? Backing up the policies, we then have procedures. The procedures tell us in detail what we're going to do. They may be embedded into the policy or it may be a second separate document. It doesn't matter. There are advantages and disadvantages both ways, okay? But they outline what we're going to do in any given foreseeable circumstance, and they need to be sufficiently flexible to say, in an unforeseen circumstance, this is what we expect you to do. This is who you would take advice from, okay? We do need to be careful to make sure that our policies and our procedures are accurate, clear, and simple to follow. Write your policy for the person who's going to actually fulfill the function that you're writing about. Okay? Don't write it in clever terms. Okay? You're not writing it to impress. Okay? If you want to demonstrate your grasp of the most complex words in the English language, then go on pointless, right? But if you want to actually get people to do what you want them to do, you need to just tell them in very simple terms what you actually want them to do. If you don't tell them in simple terms, you can't be surprised if they don't do it. Okay? Avoid jargon that won't be understood by that person. Many of your policies, not all of them, will have an element that is about the procedures as well. Just one important point, your procedures must align with your local safeguarding board's policies and procedures. Okay, you will have a local safeguarding children board, a local safeguarding adult board. They are going to change over the next 8 to 9 months, and I can't tell you what's going to happen, but there are changes afoot. But there is a group, at the moment we call them local safeguarding children's board, local safeguarding adults board, and you have to comply. It's a requirement on us, according to the national guidance, that your policies and procedures align with those. Okay, codes of conduct. Now, I would suggest to you that there is one code of conduct that is absolutely essential if you are working with children and young people, and that is a code of conduct for your staff and volunteers. Okay? This simply outlines what is acceptable behaviour and what are the boundaries that you don't cross. Okay? It doesn't need to be hugely clever, it doesn't need to be hugely complicated, but it just sets the basic principles. I think actually this stuff is probably the easiest stuff, because this is just kind of the outworking of what we believe. We believe that all people are made in the image of God. We believe that they're all valuable to Him, these kinds of things. So we're gonna build a framework around that. I would suggest to you that there are some other codes of conduct that are worth considering. I would have a code of conduct for the children who attend groups, if you have kids' groups, okay? Or for adults who attend groups, if you had adults' groups. These talk about what's the expected standard of behaviour. Now, the reason I would do this is because there are occasions where we have to impose sanctions on children. Now, that happens, it's always happened, okay? But in the olden days, we just kind of did it, okay? We kind of almost made it up as we went along a few years back, right? And it didn't matter, but now there's increasing scrutiny and transparency. The question now is the sanction proportionate to the offence? And are the sanctions consistent across different situations that you have to deal with? So a policy that says, this is what we expect by way of behaviour, and if you don't, if you're not meeting, this is the process that we'll use, you know, this is how the warnings work, and if you don't know, take note of the warning, this is what will happen next, and this is what, so it just outlines those kinds of things. I would also have the same thing for parents, by the way, particularly if you're working in a very difficult area where you've got lots of parents who aren't believers. They drop the kids off at the door and then they kind of pick them up anywhere within about the first, sort of about half an hour after the group finishing. If you're working in that kind of an area, really think about having a code of conduct for parents, particularly for the protection of your staff. Now, there's another one that at the moment isn't a big issue, but I think over the next couple of years, this is one that is going to become huge, and that's a code of conduct around pastoral care and discipleship. And that is going to become huge. Now, I've not got time to get into that, but for those of you who are involved in pastoral care and those kinds of issues, that is going to be, in my view, that's going to be one of the next big developments that we're going to see, is how do we make sure that pastoral care is caring and is not manipulative and overbearing and those kinds of issues. You do need systems. Now, systems are simply the kind of stuff that makes the rest of that other stuff work, okay? So you need some kind of a concerns form. If a youth worker or a children's worker or someone working with a vulnerable adult has a concern about someone, you need a method of recording that, of keeping that safe, keeping it confidential, and responding appropriately. So all of those things sort of come into what I would describe as being systems. Do think carefully about your systems. Again, kind of the days when you kind of went, oh yeah, somewhere we've got a concern form somewhere. Oh yeah, there it is. We'll find it. Who is it that we file this with? And we kind of leave it on the desk in the vestry or in the office and what have you for someone to pick up when they come in, and hopefully someone will recognise it's their responsibility. Right, those days are gone. Right. They've got to be stored, we've got to be able to retrieve them, they've got to be accessible to the people who need them, and they've got to be confidential in terms of people who shouldn't have access to them, okay? So good systems to handle all of that kind of stuff. Now, culture is critical. Culture is critical. We often use the kind of, and I know it's a very overused analogy, but you know the kind of two wings of the aeroplane analogy, right? One wing is your policies and procedures and systems, and that's really important. But the other wing is your culture. the culture that you create within the church. Now, again, I've given you a few thoughts, kind of that openness and transparency and accountability and all these kinds of things. But I just want to say two key things about culture. Okay. Firstly, culture needs to be intentionally formed. If you do not create the culture, others will create it for you. And if others create it for you, it will probably be below the standard that you wanted. Okay? It's kind of like someone asking, it's like asking someone to write their own job description, right? If you ask your new employee to write their own job description, they will probably leave things out that you want in there because they want to make their life a bit easier. Right? Now, culture is the same. If you don't set the standard, someone else will set it for you, and it will probably be below the standard that you want it to be at. Okay, so firstly, think about your culture. Culture is not a byproduct of the policies and procedures and systems. If you do that, you won't be safe. Because quite frankly, the minimum legal standards are not good enough. Okay. Secondly, the culture needs to be formed from the highest levels of the organisation and needs to be pervasive throughout. How many of you are designated leads, the kind of lead person within the church for safeguarding? Okay, now put your hands down. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands on this next question. But I would suggest to you that there are probably quite a few of you, and your experience of being designated lead was that the leadership decided that you would be a good person to do it. And so you do it, and they basically say, if you've got a problem, come and talk to us. Okay? Now, I don't want you to put hands up. That is not, there are a lot more of you who are trustees, that is not discharging our duty. That is called abdication of responsibility. Okay? As trustees, as leaders, it is our job to make sure that safeguarding is done well, and it is our job to support and to equip the person that we delegate that task to so that they are competent and confident in the fulfillment of that role. You have a legal duty to make sure that this stuff is done right. Therefore, you don't simply give them the folders and all the forms and let them get on with it. Okay? You have not discharged your duty. You have abdicated responsibility if that's the approach. Okay? And I do believe very genuinely this is the natural outworking of the gospel principles. The final area that I want to talk to you about is the integration of all of the previous points. You need to have a system that hangs together coherently and that is supported by and not contradicted by the culture. Okay? So the way it all comes together is really important. Okay, imagine the creation of a safety net. Okay, the ideal way to create a safety net is that everything is linked to everything else. Yeah, sometimes when we're training, we do an exercise. I'm not going to do it, but we get everybody to stand in a big circle. We have a ball of wool, okay, and we have a balloon. And we say, right, I want you to create a safety net such that the balloon can't fall through. And the only way to do it so that you've got a solid, you know, a good stable net all the way across is it's every individual is connected to every other individual. It's the same with your policies, procedures, culture, and all the rest of the stuff we've been talking. If it's not connected together well, children will fall through the gaps. And it is as simple as that. Now, we're just giving you an overview today, okay? Now, I'm going to skip this because I just want to talk very, very quickly about these, and then I'm going to throw questions open on everything, okay? Now, where do we fit in, Christian Safeguarding Services? Where do we fit in? Well, Suso, we're working in partnership with those other organisations. At the moment, Christian Safeguarding Services is a part of our company. In other words, we work professionally in this field. We train people like social care staff, sure start staff, schools, early years settings, what have you, all that kind of stuff. And we've been developing stuff for churches which approaches safeguarding from a biblical perspective. We are in the process at the moment of transferring it, so it is going to become a charity for a variety of reasons, but at the moment it's part of our organisation. We really believe that if we simply apply our biblical principles, we will far exceed any standard that the government sets for us. Because the Lord Jesus sets a far higher standard for us than any government will ever do. And so we want to say, we want to help churches just to think about this so that we do what Jesus wants us to do, we do what Scripture asks us to do, but we do it in a way that complies with what the government wants. In essence, what we're trying to do our safeguarding in such a way that it's glorifying to God. Peter said, didn't he? Let your good works speak for themselves. He says, so that even when people look at what you're doing and accuse you of evil, they'll see your good works and give glory to God. And that's kind of where we're coming from on the safeguarding area. So what we're trying to do is offer high-quality support to churches and other faith-based organisations, support that is biblically faithful, support that doesn't manipulate the Scripture to make the point we want to make, but that is biblically faithful. We want to build competence and confidence in churches. We don't want you feeling we've got to go to an expert to do this. What we want to do is help you, equip you to have the skills and the knowledge that you need. We want to be cost effective. We want to provide a flexible range of services so that those churches who've got lots of expertise, you just come in and just get updates and you can get that free of charge. If you're a church that needs a bit more support, it might be chargeable, but it's cost effective. But you can come in at whatever level is most useful to you. If all you need to do is go on the website, get the free resources, and go off and do it yourselves. That's great, okay? Because that's going to support your gospel work. We want to work in partnership with churches. So what we do, we have a website which is being developed currently. There's a number of free resources. For example, one of the free resources that we have available at the moment is an audit tool that allows you to look at how are we doing, okay? Have we thought about in those key areas that we've just been talking about? What are the questions we need to ask to think about? We have regular newsletters, which will just keep you up to date with changes and new ideas and what's going on, best practice. Have a full range of training packages that are available to you. We can help with policy development and audits of your systems and a whole range of consultancies. We have advice support lines, all of these kinds of things. So we can offer you anything from a website that you dip into and dip out of when you want it, right through to a full sort of all singing, all dancing service, as it were. You've got contact details for us there, which are on your handouts. And at that point, I'm going to stop talking because we've gone on way too long already. I am going to throw open to questions. Now, can I just, before I do that, we've got about another 10 minutes officially, haven't we? Thereabouts. Okay, that's what I'm thinking anyway. That's what I was told. We've got about another 10 minutes. If folks need to slip out and others have still got questions they want to ask, we're going to be around. Okay, we might have to vacate this room, but we're going to be around. So if you've kind of had enough and you've got what you need and you want to leave, that's fine. If you haven't and you want to be asking questions, then we're happy to stay for as long as necessary and to continue to converse with you after this event as well, if that's helpful. Are there any questions that anybody has?
What's the difference between yourselves and the CCPAS?
Okay, yeah. The answer to that really is we're both working in exactly the same field. We're both trying to achieve exactly the same things, okay? CCPAS have been around for a long time. Look, CPAS have done a really, really great work over many, many years. Now, the first thing I would say is have a look at the AA report, okay? And I don't want to speak for them. I just want to let them speak for themselves. I think one of the things with CPAS is that they're very, very good at big denominations. They're very, very good at doing big denominations. One of the pieces of feedback of that I've had is it's not quite so easy to translate it into an independent church where you haven't got that structure. Our background is independency. I mean, I grew up as a Baptist, but Baptists are largely independents anyway. And for many, many years, we've been in FIEC-type churches. So we come very much from independency. And I think the other thing would be that theologically, we're a bit more conservative. So theologically, we would kind of sit very, very squarely with, well, obviously, we're an FIEC church. That's what we're subscribed to. That's kind of where we would sit. Whereas I think CPAS are a slightly broader, theologically based organisation. We were at Christian Resource Exhibition a few weeks back. 318s had, as they are now, had their stand, a few stands up from us. We were chatting away with them. We're both trying to achieve the same thing, which is help churches to do safeguarding well. I think we understand independency a bit better than they do. That's probably not a great thing for me to say. That sounds a little bit big-headed, doesn't it? But I think we do, because I think that's where we've come from. That's what we live, breathe, sleep. And I think theologically we're a bit narrower. Is that okay?
I've only just recently become aware of the spiritual abuse policies that, say, the Baptist Union and the Church of England and others.
Right.
And I literally stumbled across it on a website. Are your resources sort of older and, you know, are they part of the package that you offer?
Okay, so can I just clarify, when you say the resources, can you just clarify me? Because that's a huge question.
Yeah, so there's a Baptist Union, I mean, on this particular website, they had examples of all the different PDF policies that, say, the
right.
Baptist Union have
right.
on the specific issue of spiritual abuse.
Yes.
So to do with the LGBTIQ
right. plus yes.
issue. Someone comes into church, they hear a sermon on Leviticus 18, they go away feeling offended.
Yeah,
You're in trouble. What are you going to do about it?
Okay. So spiritual abuse is a relatively new concept. It's been kicking around since, in academic circles, since about 2012, 2013. It's really taken prominence in churches over the last 2 to 3 years, and there's been quite a big drive around that. Now, if you go to the EA report, what they will suggest to you is that there are various challenges with that in terms of unintended consequences, particularly around legal definitions and these kinds of things. What we do also know is that various people are jumping on the spiritual abuse bandwagon and seeking to promote secular perspectives, but using spiritual abuse as a concept. We don't tend to use the term spiritual abuse other than in saying to people, this is our position on this thing that is called abuse. We tend to refer to so-called spiritual abuse. The reason for that is that we believe that what spiritual abuse is an abuse of power within a faith context, which in essence is not greatly different to an abuse of power in any other context. So, the next thing is we don't have template policies. Okay, we will not give you a template policy. That's not because we haven't got them. It's not because we can't write them. Neither is it because we can't be bothered. It's because I think actually template policies are quite dangerous. One of the things that is really, really important, and we talked at the very beginning about the fact that there's that delegated responsibility, that we have that flexibility to write or do. You need to own your policy. Now, what we have as an alternative to that, and it doesn't mention spiritual abuse, is what we're describing as a policy framework. So what the policy framework does is it says, on your safeguarding policy, these are the things you need to ask and these are the questions you need to answer, but we won't give you cut and paste text, okay? Because I think it's dangerous. Because I think, and I see this again and again when churches say, when I say to churches, can you send me over your policy? You look at it and you know exactly where it came from. Because what they've basically done is taken the logo off the top, put their own logo on the top, changed the church name, changed a few names and a few phone numbers in the middle of it. But it's essentially just a cut and paste job. Now, the problem with that is, what that says to me is that probably what we're dealing with is a church where it goes into the folder. It probably comes out once a year, if you're lucky, when it's time to review it, if we're actually sufficiently on the ball to review it annually, which we should be doing. But there's no ownership of the document because it was just... And so what we want you to do is to take ownership of that document. So we will help you write it, but we won't give you a cut-and-paste approach to it. And we don't mention spiritual abuse, but we do mention the abuse of power within a church context. Does that answer the question?
I guess so. I mean, I guess it'll depend on where the secular agenda takes the spiritual abuse route. And if that does then, you know, morph into something bigger and more scary over the next year or two, then I guess everyone will just have to get their act together.
And I think the intersection between this seminar and the one that Edward Connors are running, where he's talking about legal compliance, is really important. Having charitable aims which clearly define what our positions are and make explicit reference to our statement of faith. And these kinds of issues become absolutely critical at that point.
I was going to say, we've just become a CIO.
Great.
And so we have stated aims in our constitution.
Yes.
So in a sense, if somebody challenges what we say from the pulpit or in Bible study, as long as we are in line with our stated charitable aims,
correct.
I guess we are protected. Aren't we?
Correct. That's absolutely right. So long as your governing documents specifically reference your statement of faith, and your statement of faith clearly articulates your position, your trustees are actually in breach of the law if they fail to uphold the statement of faith.
Right.
right? Because the governing document says that we operate in line with our statement of faith. Now, that for us as churches is, in the olden days, that was just kind of, that was bureaucracy, right? Now, that is life and death. Okay, so if your governing documents aren't solid and don't legally bind you to working in line with your statement of faith, you need to think. But that's a bigger question than a safeguarding question, because it's about the governance of the whole of the church. So that's where we have an intersection between what we're talking about and what the guys over in Edward Connors are talking about at the same time, and we need to bring those two things together.
It's not really a question, but it's a statement.
Yeah,
is
sure.
That, well, two things, really. One is that I don't think churches these days, or churches, don't have a clear idea how to exercise church discipline.
Right.
So we've actually put together a document that articulates what church discipline looks like in practice in the family.
Yeah.
That's one.
I think that's really, really important, a really important point to make. And it kind of links in with what I was saying about complaints procedures and all those kinds of things. Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, and your second point?
And the other thing is we've had to recently deal with FGM.
Yes.
Do you deal with that at all?
It is included in the
female gender mutilation.
Yeah, sorry, female genital mutilation. We do... It's not in the sense of kind of offering support to survivors or those kinds of things. It is a fundamental part of any kind of safeguarding training. It's one of the required things to talk about. There is such a thing as the FGM duty, which doesn't apply to churches, but in principle does apply to us. And it certainly is something that we would talk about where that was required. Absolutely, yeah.
I'm a chair of governors, so we've made sure all our governors have gone through that training with the local authority.
Yeah, because there's a mandatory duty for yourselves, isn't there? Absolutely.
And if you can get access to those who need to have that, it's really good training.
Yeah.
You need to be made of stern stuff to go through it, because it's quite...
But there's a very good online training around FGM. But again, we can support either on a one-to-one basis or through the training with that.
Part of my role is that I deliver forced marriage on a base violence and FGM training, so... we've got that expertise. I do it, Paul doesn't, but I'm sure he could.
Thanks. I just wanted to clarify something about the definition of safeguarding.
Yes.
Andy said, keeping children as safe as we possibly can.
Yes.
Within a normal context. When you came onto policies, you were talking about what is sensible and proportionate.
Yes.
Which is different from as safe as possible.
Yeah, okay. So the way that this comes together is that there's a principle in safeguarding which is we refer to as the principle of paramountcy. The principle of paramountcy says that for those of us who are working with children and young people, the protection of children should be of paramount importance. Okay. Now, the way that I would articulate this, and this is my articulation, not the legal statement, okay? The way that I would articulate this is, if we were to walk into your Sunday school youth group, group with older vulnerable people, whatever it is, what we should do is that if we just observe, we should see that safeguarding matters. That if it's paramount, if it's top priority task for us, we should just be able to observe it, right? The way that you interact with people, the way that you interact with each other, the way that we care for people. So the principle of paramountcy is one of the fundamental principles of safeguarding. And so when I say we need proportionate systems, I'm saying proportionate to live up to that standard of paramountcy, which is what Andy was saying. Now, what at the point that Andy is making is none of us can guarantee that something won't happen in our church. None of us can guarantee that a child won't come in who's been harmed. None of us can guarantee that a volunteer won't come in who harms a child and those kinds of things. And one of my frustrations, and I'll just kind of vent for a second or two, one of my frustrations is that very often when there's a serious case review, particularly a high-profile serious case review, the media always kind of have something of a frenzy. They look for someone to blame. The serious case review comes out. They interview some poor soul from the local authority, often a director of children's services or someone to do with the Safeguarding Children Board. And one of the questions that invariably comes out is, can you now guarantee that this will never happen again? Right? Now, bottom line, no one can. And I think that's what you were getting at, wasn't it? So we need to be working in line with the principle of paramountcy. We need absolutely to be keeping children as safe as we possibly can. We develop systems and approach to that which is proportionate to the risk that is associated with the activity that we're doing. So If you're not doing any work with children and teenagers, you know some of those policies you won't need because you're not doing that kind of work. So it's not a one size fits all, is what we're trying to say, really. You know, think about what you're doing and think about what do you need to achieve that principle of paramountcy, but in a way that is appropriate to you. It's one of the reasons I don't like cut and paste policies, because they don't actually relate to what you're actually doing on the ground.
Thank you, Paul. We need to draw to a close our session